This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, April 15th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In Philadelphia last week, Bill Clinton was speaking in support of Hillary when he began addressing a Black Lives Matter protester about the crime bill he shepherded through Congress during his presidency.
We have 13-year-old kids planning their own funerals. She don't want to hear any of that. You know what else she doesn't want to hear? Because of that bill, we had a 25-year low in crime, a 33 low in the murder rate, year low murder rate. And who you think those lives were that mattered? Whose lives were saved that mattered?
Ben Wallace Wells is here to discuss Hillary's legacy as a 90s-era Democrat and how it's faring against the progressive surge of 2016. Ben, listening to Bill Clinton last week, I was thinking about after Baltimore and Ferguson, those terrible episodes, Hillary gave a major speech against mass incarceration, a very good one, and Bill at that point repudiated his crime legislation. But that unguarded moment last week seemed to show that the bind that the Clintons are in during a political moment that is so unlike the one they faced when he was president. Could you remind us what the country looked like at that time? Younger voters weren't even born yet.
Yeah. Well, the country looked like it was in a real fix. When Clinton took over, the economy had been, during the end of the George H.W. Bush administration, had been really plummeting. The crime wave, though somewhat declining, was still an incredibly vivid fact of life. And there wasn't the certainty that came later, that came during the 90s, that America was on the way up. And so the politics of the Clintons, just sort of remarkable, aspirational knitting together of pro-entrepreneurship, pro-capitalist feeling with the old Democratic sensitivities towards race, towards the working and middle class, was really a phenomenal thing. It really, you know, helped in many ways create the Democratic Party that we've got today. It helped give the left a kind of compact that it could stand on, at least for a little while.
Many say that Bill Clinton got elected and saved the party by moving it to the center.
And it's hard to look back at the Obama years and not feel that legacy. I mean, you know, Obama's a different politician, and he has a kind of different orientation. In many ways, he's a little bit more left. But that kind of caution, that consciousness of coalition, that sensitivity towards industry and business, it's hard to imagine that in a liberal presidency, that strain would have been there had the Clintons not done what they did during the 1990s.
One thing that was evident in the debate last night and has been evident throughout her campaign is the extent to which she draws on Obama's legacy. And I hadn't thought about it in terms of how much it reflects what he was building on from what Bill Clinton had established before.
It's interesting the way that she's been casting Bernie out from the inner circle recently has been saying, you know, is he even a Democrat? Is he even part of the party? And I think that for her, for the Clintons, that has a real meaning. You know, they have been nothing if not loyal partisans over the last quarter century, you know. And the Democratic Party that she is skeptical, that he is in any meaningful way committed to, Bernie even himself can be a little bit ambivalent about that, saying, you know, I'm running as a Democrat rather than I am a Democrat. That is the important thing for her. That is sort of the essential unit. And there's a way in which when you look at the coalitions that she's been able to draw on in this election, you know, that's what she's got right now. She's got not just loyalties, but an idea of how the Democratic Party comes together. She's got, you know, a way of talking to donors that does not alienate the base. She has a way of appealing to and citing a common history with African-American voters to become a real sorts of strength and support for her in this election in a way that they obviously weren't in the last one.
Yeah, and she's trying to draw out the compassion that she feels she has and she's not adequately conveying to the public. And one of the most effective ways has been, most recently, has been this cause that she's made of the mothers who have lost children to gun violence, who I guess are now campaigning with her.
Yeah, they are. A number of them are going around to different states with her. I think that the thing that's kind of gotten lost in this primary campaign is that Hillary Clinton is not just a compromise figure. Her liberal tradition is very different from Bernie Sanders. It's not one of mass class consciousness. It's one of individual liberation.
Explain that a little bit more.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that if you look at her own political history, at her own history as sort of a public advocate, the causes that she has been drawn to that have been central to her ascent have been the kind of post-60s fights for liberation, you know, the fight for women's rights, the fight for racial equality. And Bernie Sanders comes from a, sort of a very different, more old left tradition, right, where his sensitivities are towards the mass. The question is not something exactly like affirmative action. You know, is it possible for a talented individual to get ahead in this country? It's more a question of, you know, let's forget about the talented individuals for a second. What's happening to the, you know, the person who's in the 80th percentile on the economic ladder? Some on the left have been a little bit cynical about the relationship between Hillary Clinton and African-American voters, say it's sort of institutional or a matter of personal loyalties or whatever. But there is also a real, I think, a real philosophical attraction there, which is that her fights have always been fights for things that feel a lot like the civil rights movement, for racial equality, for gender equality.
And you think that still plays well in an era of Black Lives Matter and other grassroots movements that we can see?
I think that you see some of the chafe. I think that if you look at what Black Lives Matter is, at the issues that it's focused on, it is some kind of hybrid of a kind of older civil rights sensibility that is about individual liberation and a kind of more left-wing mass consciousness. You know, the issues that Black Lives Matter have taken up are not really about, you know, how does a talented middle-class person get ahead in this country, though they inform that. They're about the immediate and sort of emotional crisis of people being stopped by police and beat up and sometimes killed. And the people in that case, the African-Americans who are victims of those police crimes, who are the sources of the rage and deep feeling behind the Black Lives Matter movement, are notable for their anonymity. They could be anybody. And so in, I think, the Black Lives Matter movement, and I think you also see echoes of this in the LGBT movement, in the push to include transgender rights in a more central place in the platform of LGBT groups. I think that there is a way in which the civil rights causes that we have now and the causes of individual liberation look a little bit more complicated and a little bit more distant from her natural way of talking and understanding than they might have been 15 or 20 years ago. And you see that right in that episode with Bill Clinton. And the rhetoric that supported that was a kind of punching down rhetoric. Hillary Clinton calling criminals super predators, which, yes, Bernie Sanders is right, is very racially charged, you know? And so I think that there is a way in which she has this very powerful tradition that she stands in hand with of individual liberation, of civil rights. And yet that tradition has evolved a little bit. And part of what we're seeing in this campaign is her sort of trying to catch up to the times with that, you know, her trying to bridge that gap.
Yeah, you see it in all kinds of ways. The pressure from Bernie Sanders has led her to repudiate NAFTA, three strikes,
yeah,
charter schools. These are all policies that her husband used to support. Last night at the Democratic debate, she said she'd agree to a phased-in $15 an hour minimum wage, which she,
yeah,
hadn't said before.
The thing that's hanging over this whole election in many ways is the economic collapse of 2008. And though we have been talking a lot about the 1990s, I think that really what we're talking about and really where the kind of emotional energy behind the Sanders campaign comes from is what were the conditions and choices that we made that got us to the economic collapse,
yes,
in 2008. And when you come out of that experience, which is, you know, you see the marks of it in the Trump campaign and, you know, in the, you know, Paul Ryan repudiating the makers and takers rhetoric that he'd been so excited about 4 years ago. It's been an incredibly powerful experience for the country. And the old kind of pro-business sensibility, the old compact that the Clintons made with with 80s capitalism, it just doesn't look so good anymore. It got us to this.
And I have to say that one of the best moments in last night's debate, I thought, was Sanders nailing her again. And he just keeps coming back to this on her refusal to release her three speeches to Goldman Sachs, for which she was paid $675,000.
So isn't that incredible?
Totally incredible. And when she said she'd taken on the big banks and all the rest of it, he said, "Whoa, they must have been very, very upset by what you did." And he's right.
He's absolutely right. This is one part of that kind of Medici atmosphere around the Clintons that, you know, they've never seemed to really eradicate that kind of icky relationship with money. The ways in which the presence of very rich individuals, Bill Clinton's buddies, you know, the donors to the Clinton Foundation, sort of perverts the choices you make. This is an issue that is not new. Hillary Clinton has been trying to find some convincing way to defend herself against this for months now. And she hasn't come up with anything. She's offered basically no defense.
And why do you think she won't release these speeches? Because it's going to be endless fodder about her kowtowing to the banks?
I can't imagine that it would be worse than what it is. I feel like it's just a bad decision by the campaign. I think that what could she have possibly said that will deepen or worsen the impression that people have of her relationship with Wall Street? I mean, you can imagine some sort of heated, enthusiastic things, but like it's hard to imagine Hillary Clinton saying them. She's a very cautious politician.
Yes.
So my feeling is basically just that it's probably political miscalculation. They probably, you know, the Clintons have always had a kind of defensive circle the wagons campaign strategy, and this feels like more of the same.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Even 6 months ago, the idea that a Democratic socialist could compete effectively against the two Clintons, it would have been almost inconceivable. It's still likely she'll be the nominee and that I assume that Bernie supporters will rally around her. But don't you think something has changed? Do you think that the average citizen still has the same loyalty to the party that you were talking about earlier? We're seeing the Republicans grapple with this in a truly existential way.
Yeah. I think that we should also just give Bernie Sanders credit. I mean, this has been a remarkable campaign. He has not just made his case effectively, but he's honed in on the basic moral issue in the country right now very precisely and very consistently. The way in which I have been most surprised, I think, by the Sanders campaign is how deft he's been at channeling the kind of essential optimism that came out of the Obama campaigns. When you thought of Bernie Sanders for the last decade or two decades, it was as a curmudgeon. It was as a naysayer. And the way in which he's been able to knit a critique of the way that the country is going that goes very deep with a kind of basic optimism about the people and its future has been really remarkable to see, and I didn't expect, 6 months ago. So I think it's true that the Democratic Party is subject to some of the same forces that the Republican Party is. And, you know, the kind of economic inequality that we have in the country hits everybody. It hits Republicans. It hits Democrats. But it's also true that the Sanders campaign has just been really deftly and well run.
I want to get back to something you said earlier, which is how Hillary's been emphasizing gender and the fact that she's been on this case for a very long time around the world, takes a village, all the rest of it. This is a genuine cause for her. She didn't emphasize her gender in 2008.
Yeah.
But is it working with young female voters?
It doesn't seem to be in the way that she would most want, which is for them to say, I recognize that this is a person who is basically on my side. It feels as if, you know, and you see this again and again in the polls, that in the exit polls, that young female voters, though they don't vote for Bernie Sanders, I've quite seen extraordinary margins that young male voters do. You know, women in their 20s are going for Bernie Sanders by overwhelming numbers. But I think we should think about the general election here a little bit. You know, it seems very likely that Hillary Clinton is going to be up against Donald Trump, somebody who at times just brushes up against misogyny, and that's his good days.
Well,
you know?
Or even goes further than that.
Yes, on his bad days, he's much, much beyond that. And if it's not Trump, it's likely to be Ted Cruz, who can invoke similar passions. The groundwork she's laying here is for a campaign in which she says, I'm the decent one. I'm the one who knows where all the buttons are. I'm not somebody who's going to beat up on somebody who I think is weaker than me. Her long history of fighting for women's rights, and in a more basic way, just being a symbol of female accomplishment and gender equality. That's not enough to offset the general leftward movement among young millennial Democrats. Like, there's no doubt about that. Those people are much more comfortable. Those young voters are much more comfortable with something that looks like socialism than, you know, she might have thought they would be 15 years ago. But if we think about the general election, then I think this stuff matters very much. I think that as a country, we've rejected racism and misogyny and the sort of open anger that you have seen bubbling up among many of the Republicans a long time ago. And I think she's set herself up like reasonably nicely to be the candidate of the sensible consensus, the center. It wouldn't surprise me if she picks a woman to run with her as vice president. I would bet that many of her policy ideas that she emphasizes through the general have a kind of family conscious edge to them. The way in which the Republicans have turned away from their kind of Christian family sensibility and towards a harder, more libertarian edge, I think gives her a lot of room to set herself up as sort of a defender of family.
And stealing that issue from Republicans. It's always family values have always been the Republicans' issue.
Yeah, but I think there's a way in which she is sort of benefited not just by the general craziness of the Republican primary, but of the particular ways in which the Republican Party has gone.
Okay, we're going to come back to this as the months go on. Thank you so much, Ben.
Sure.
Benjamin Wallace Wells is a staff writer. His work has been collected in the Best American Political Writing. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary from Ben Wallace Wells and others on NewYorker.com or on The New Yorker app, available at no extra charge from the App Store and Google Play. Tell us also what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review the Politics and More podcast on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.